But as a Christian, I can say that I think the reason we know that's not right is because we're made by a God in whom these moral values reside, and he's left his thumbprints all over us, so that we resemble him, and our consciences therefore reflect his. And those are times, to be honest, we sort of push our consciences to the side, don't we? Deep down, we know what we're doing, and we can't shake off these feelings of right and wrong. We know they're there. So the feelings of right and wrong that we can't shake off are themselves a signal from the one who made us. Now then, of course, as soon as you raise the question of ethics and morality, the finger points back at religious people, the Crusades, the Spanish Inquisition, Al-Qaeda. Religion, at times, has caused as many moral problems as I'm claiming it could solve. And at that point, we put our hands up, don't we? And we say, yes, that's right. As a Christian, I'm not claiming that the Christian faith makes us all perfect. What I'm saying, though, is that the Christian faith tells us when we're all wrong. For some, the question of ethics and morality raises questions to do with what the Bible teaches. I thought, as well as, like I said, stimulating and intriguing, I'll try and provoke you a little bit as well. So here's a quotation from the book of Joshua, chapter 10, verse 40, in which the writer describes how the Israelites, quote, totally destroyed all who breathed, just as the Lord, the God of Israel, had commanded. In the context, that's seen as a good thing, whereas for many people that seems like a morally reprehensible thing. And so for some Christians, this raises a question about, you know, right and wrong, and can we trust the Bible? And maybe that's a subject you want to talk about. Remember, of course, in this room tonight, you're not allowed to say that's wrong unless you also acknowledge that there is some transcendent moral being on the grounds of whose moral framework you say it's wrong. If you just mean I disagree with it, that's fine. But in order to say anything is right or wrong, we need to appeal to a higher authority. When pressed, some evolutionists acknowledge the ethical emptiness of their system. I'll get back to Richard Dawkins again. One way of cutting this knot, you see, if you say science and science alone doesn't let you deal with ethics. See, one way in which an atheist scientist would deal with that is by saying, yeah, that's right. And there's no such thing as ethics. There's no such thing as right and wrong. There's no such thing as good and evil. Remarkably, some atheist scientists are even willing to say that. And I don't want to pick on him, but Richard Dawkins does sometimes walk into it, doesn't he? The quotation right at the bottom right-hand corner of the page, he says, the universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. And I think what's interesting about that is that he knows that that's where an atheist scientific framework drives him, and he can't bring himself to acknowledge that it's wrong. The world does not have precisely the properties that we should predict if there is no such thing as good and evil. It just doesn't. You and I are part of the world, and we know good and evil. So at this point, if science is all there is, it's wrong. But science isn't all there is. And I think that Richard Dawkins has opened the door there to show us that. That's number three. Now, number four, go to the top left-hand corner. I want to talk about a couple of things which will intrigue the physicists and cosmologists that might totally baffle the rest of us, and I mean us, because me included at times, this baits my noodle. But I'll try and make this comprehensible to people who don't have PhDs in mathematics. I want to talk about the question of cosmic fine-tuning. And the quotation from Paul Davies at the top left-hand corner summarises very nicely the point that I want to make at this point. Let me read it again. He's a physicist, and he says, it seems as though someone has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. The impression of design is overwhelming. Someone has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. The impression of design is overwhelming. He's not now saying, look at a caterpillar, the impression of design is overwhelming. He's looking, so to speak, at a much more microscopic level. He's recognizing that there are a very small number of physical constants, a small number of numbers, which describe how the smallest atomic and subatomic particles interact with each other. And the balance between these numbers and the precise values of these numbers are so exactly right. If they were a tiny, tiny, tiny bit different, this universe either would not be able to support life or it wouldn't exist at all. And the precision with which these numbers are matched is quite simply breathtaking. I want to just try and illustrate that. There's one or two which are kind of low-level breathtaking, but physicists among you follow this. If you're not a physicist, give us 20 seconds, okay? The ratio between the helium and beryllium ground state energy levels, if it differed by 1%, there would be no carbon in the universe. Biologists, now you know, there's a problem if there's no carbon in the universe, because intelligent life, all life pretty much, is carbon-based. But 1% is nothing compared to some other examples of fine-tuning. Let me skip over some of the intermediate ones and go straight to the most baffling of all. Consider these two physical constants, the electromagnetic force constant and the gravitational force constant. And you have to picture yourself as the creator, or whatever it was that was there before the universe existed. And you've got your hand on the dials, and there are two dials. One is labelled electromagnetic force constant, and the other is labelled gravitational force constant. Now, you've got to tweak the values on these dials so that the universe works. Now, if you get the value on these dials out by a tiny, tiny amount, the universe won't work at all. And the precision with which you've got to balance the numbers is 100 billion billionth of 1%. If you're out by that much, the universe won't work. It will either contain all big stars or all small stars. It won't contain the right balance of big stars and small stars. Turns out you need big stars to make heavy elements, small stars to last long enough to allow planets to form and so on. So if you get it out by 100 billion, 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 billionth of 1%, you're not going to have a universe that works. Now, I've got no idea how to visualise a number like that. 1 part in 10 to the 40. Until I came across this illustration from a chap called Hugh Ross, who says, here's how to visualise that phenomenally tiny probability. Imagine the continent of North America. Imagine covering the continent of North America with coins. So you go around, you start, I don't know, Washington State, and you lay your first coin down. You cover Washington State and you go along into Idaho or wherever's next, and you cover the whole of Montana with coins. The distant far reaches of the prairies, and all the way down to Florida, and that's taken you, I don't know how many years to do that, with coins. And the whole of North America is now covered with coins, and you go all the way back to the Northwest and you do it again. You lay another layer of coins down. You put another layer of coins, and you do 3, 4, 5, 10, 50, 100 layers of coins, and you keep doing it. Keep adding the coins to the pile until the pile reaches to the moon. Okay? And then you do the same again with 1 million other continents the same size. And then you paint this coin red, and you hide it in one of the piles, and you blindfold your best friend and ask her to pick it out. Now, the odds are about 1 in 10 to the 40 that she'll get it right first time. Now, that shows you how unfathomably unlikely this universe is. And physicists are simply baffled by it. I can understand why. Physicists, that is, except physicists who are Christians, who have a way of understanding how a world can be like this because there is a greater intelligence at work in it and behind it and before it. Cosmic fine-tuning. More basic than that, really, is the order, the cosmic order of the universe. Those of you who are scientists, actually all of us can understand this really. When you do science, you assume that there is a degree of regularity and order in the way the universe works. In fact, it's the same as when you bake bread or when you play tennis or whenever you do anything that involves stuff in the world, you assume that the physical laws which describe the way the universe works stay the same. That's one of the assumptions of science. You know, the law of gravity is going to sort of change direction halfway through your experiment. So that means that in the scientific world, you can do the same experiment half a dozen times, and it will give you the same result if it's done the same way. And then your colleagues across the street can then reproduce the experiment. They can check the results, make sure you haven't got anything wrong. The same conditions produce the same results. The universe behaves reproducibly. But now you ask yourself the philosophical question, why? Why should it even do that? We are so used to a universe that behaves in that way that it hardly strikes us as strange. But the people who've thought hard about it, it strikes me as very strange indeed. I don't mean to prove anything just by quoting Einstein, but I do think he is something of an authority when it comes to physics. And he says, quote, "The most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible." Again, "I consider the comprehensibility of the world as a miracle or an eternal mystery. It's inexplicable. Why should the world be even susceptible to mathematical analysis, never mind predictable in the way that it is?" When it comes to maths, he says, again, this is Eugene Wigner, he's a physicist, sorry, not Albert Einstein, "The enormous usefulness of mathematics in the natural sciences is something bordering on the mysterious, and there is no rational explanation for it. It is an article of faith." Now, hold on a second. Now, he didn't sign his physics death warrant by saying this. That's an interesting difference, actually, between the world of physics and the world of biology, as a ex-physicist, really. I can tell you that discussions about the existence of God in a context with other physicists are not met with derision and contempt, actually. I think they get such conversations get a more frosty reception in biology departments, because people perceive, there's one or two nods, perhaps, from people who are professional biologists. Physicists don't sign their death warrant by saying things like this. They're just observing that they work on the premise that the world is rational, ordered, susceptible to mathematical analysis, and they shrug their shoulders and they don't know why, and it's okay. Science isn't wrong, it's just you've reached the limit of what science can explain. If you believe in God, you can go beyond that limit and say, the reason why the world is rational and ordered is because there is a rational and ordered God who upholds it and keeps it in being. It is striking, and we could talk about this at some length, how dependent the rise of modern science was upon a Christian worldview, upon a worldview that gave a rational, gave a theological basis to the claim that the universe should behave in a rational way. And if we had more time, which we're running out of, we could talk about Fibonacci numbers, daisies, stock prices, the Trinity, and so on. But we'll talk about, if you want to ask me about daisies and Fibonacci numbers, ask me later. Finally, we come to the question of miracles. Again, like with creation and evolution, here is a basic, apparent conflict between the Christian claim, quote, "He is not here, he has risen." Quotations from the Bible, the description of what the first people who went to the tomb after Jesus' burial found there. And the kind of gut instinct, buttressed by experience, let's say, that miracles just don't happen, right? Now, at this point, I don't want to try and prove that miracles can happen. What I want to do is to raise a couple of problems with claiming that they can't. First, there are some fairly eminent and thoughtful people who are used to assessing evidence who think that it's not completely outrageous. Take Lord Darling, for example, the former Lord Chief Justice, here discussing the resurrection of Jesus. He says, in favour of believing that this event actually happened, there exists such overwhelming evidence, positive and negative, factual and circumstantial, that no intelligent jury in the world could fail to bring in a verdict that the resurrection story is true. I hope, if you weren't persuaded that the resurrection story is true, I hope you're not now persuaded, because just reading a quote from Lord Darling shouldn't persuade you, but it should give you pause for thought, shouldn't it? It should make us all think, if we just dismissed it before, there's something here to examine. And when you examine it, what's going to happen is, you'll discover this, like you read the Gospel of Matthew, for example, we quoted from that a minute ago, and you'll read this stuff and you think, I can't believe that, because that just doesn't happen. What you've just said, that can't happen, is actually a logical fallacy. You have stumbled upon what is known to philosophers as the problem of induction. The problem of induction says that you can't generalize from a certain number of observations to a general rule that covers all observations. You think about the resurrection from the dead and you say it just can't happen. That's the inductivist fallacy, because you said, I've never seen it happen, and I've made how many observations of dead bodies and how many dead bodies you've seen. I've never seen a dead body rise in 30, 40, 50, 80 years. Therefore it can't happen? No, you can't say that. Philosophically, it's fallacious. It's an illegitimate conclusion. It doesn't follow from the premises. Bertrand Russell illustrated this. Perhaps this story will help us to get our heads around it. With the story of the inductivist turkey. The inductivist turkey. The turkey was fed every morning in June, July, August, September by the farmer's wife, who came with a bag of grain and used to feed the turkey in August, September, October, November, December. Every morning, the inductivist turkey was fed by this friendly lady who came to fill up the feeding troughs, and the turkey concluded from this finite number of 160 odd observations that therefore life would go on forever. I've never known a day when the farmer's wife didn't come with a bag of grain and put it in the trough for me to eat, until the 23rd of December, when the farmer's wife showed it with a large knife. It would be a mistake, wouldn't it, for the turkey to conclude from the previous 100-and-something-odd observations that it could never be any different. Philosophically, he's just as fallacious, that is, committing just the same fallacy, for us to conclude that a dead man can't rise just because we've never seen it. What that means is, we have to ask, why would anybody continue to deny the possibility of the miraculous? Why would anybody continue to deny the possibility of the supernatural, even when it's obviously, logically fallacious for them to do so? And in order to demonstrate that, we dip our clothes, flip over the handout I've given you, that way up, and I want to read you the answer. This is the reason why scientists who are atheists continue to deny the supernatural and the miraculous, and therefore belief in God. This is Richard Lewontin, an atheist, writing in the New York Review of Books in 1997. It's a lengthy quote, but I'll read it all and then we'll finish and we'll take some questions. Our willingness to accept scientific claims that are against common sense is the key to an understanding of the real struggle between science and the supernatural. We take the side of science. Why do we take the side of science? Here's why we take the side of science. In spite of its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and life, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories, because we have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism. It is not that the methods and institutions of science now compel us to accept the material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, that we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Well, at least he has the merit of honesty. I think it will be better for us to consider the possibility that science, for all its power, doesn't have all the answers, and that actually, to accept the things that science can teach us, can sit perfectly happily alongside and indeed be enhanced by a robust commitment to a God who is sovereign, that is to say, in control of all things, and who came into the world miraculously in Jesus Christ and revealed himself to us, and the existence of a world that really lies beyond our phenomenal experience, but which is nonetheless real. You have been very gracious and polite as I've roughly double the amount of time that Mark said I would. Thank you so much for your attention. Mark, what do you want to do now? Do you want to take a breather and have a stretch and work your way around that complicated spider diagram and try and figure out how I managed to print the back upside down? If you rotate it like that, you can do it nicely. Feel free to chat among yourselves if you'd like to, and I will wait for the first hand to go up and then call you to order in, let's say, 30 seconds or so. Yeah, 30 seconds, just to chew over that. Then we'll take some questions.
Thank you.